This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome to the second part of the Financial Sense News Hour, second hour, and the part we usually call the big picture. You know, if you are an investor, which we're assuming a lot of our listeners are, there are many ways to make money in the stock markets. And there are several different methods that people are using. And one of them would be technical analysis. Basically, you take a look at the best looking charts and go ahead investing in those companies. One that's really popular is the elevators going up. Momentum investing. You climb on board stocks moving up the most and figure you'll make the biggest gains there. And then fundamentals. A growth investor to value investors like Warren Buffett tend to follow these. In other words, what are the market indicators actually telling you? And today we'll talk about three areas, the Fabulous Five, top momentum investors for 2017, the dogs of the Dow, as they're called. We'll tell you what all these mean a little later here, and dividend aristocrats. And why are we doing this? Well, the question is, if you were to invest using one of these three systems, where would you have done the best over a long period of time? There's always going to be one year where one of the three outperforms the other two. And you want to know what works well over a longer period of time. So that's framing what we're discussing here today.
Well, let's take a look at the Fab Five. And everybody remembers in the year 2015, it was FANG, which was an acronym for Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. Well, we've got the Fab Five this year. These are some of the top ranked, let's say, technology stocks in many ways. And this is where a lot of money has been piling into these kind of stocks. And of course, these have turned into momentum stocks, meaning that everybody's jumping on board. And these stocks this year are Facebook, Google, Netflix, Priceline, and Amazon. And here's the thing that can happen when you are investing in some of these high momentum type stocks. Number one, you can make a lot of money if you get on board early and then have the smarts to get out of these stocks when they correct. Because so much money is flowing into these kind of companies, it drives the elevation of these companies, but people don't care. If you're a momentum investor, you don't care. Whatever's going up, that's what you're going to buy. So if we take a look at these Fab Five stocks for the year, Facebook, as of this Friday, is up 30.33%. Facebook doesn't pay a dividend, and it's selling at 46 times earnings, meaning that if you're an investor, and this is where the fundamental guys come in, if you want to buy a dollar worth of earnings on Facebook, you have to pay $46 for every dollar of profit that Facebook earns. Google is another stock. It is up 17, almost 17.4 this year, and it is selling at 31 times, a little over 31 times earnings. Netflix, a very popular stock, it is up almost 23% this year, and you are paying, I love this, 200 times earnings. So for every dollar of earnings that you buy in Netflix, it costs you $200. Another momentum stock is Priceline. This stock, a lot of these stocks are up in the $900 range. I know Google's in the $900, Priceline's up there, but Priceline is up almost 26% for the year and is selling at 43 times earnings. Then, of course, everybody's favorite, Amazon. Amazon is up almost 25% for the year, and you are paying 176 times earnings. So if you were a momentum investor, and that's what we saw, which took the markets by surprise after the election. The markets just went up double digits. But where were the best gains? Well, the best gains have been in the Fab Five, because the Dow is up 6% for the year. The S&P is up 6.5%. And the NASDAQ, which is laden with technology stocks, is up roughly about 12.4%. So clearly, if you're investing in momentum stocks in 2017, you would have clearly beaten the averages, with many of these stocks up as high as 30% to as low as 17%. So you're up 3, 4, 5-fold over what the market returns are. The Fab Five stocks clearly have been market leaders, handily beating major averages this year. But the markets are paying extreme price for growth. because we've been in a low growth economy. We got the numbers for GDP in the first quarter and it was below 1%. So any company that can grow their earnings faster than the rest of the S&P or faster than the rest of the economy, you're going to pay a lot more to own those stocks. And these are what we call momentum stocks. And these are the kind of stocks that people gravitate as you get close to market tops. Now, the overall market is doing very well this year. The advanced decline line is advancing along with stocks. So it's the old saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. Most stocks are up for the year, but not necessarily all of them. So as an investment strategy, getting on board momentum stocks, if you have the insight to find out which ones are the top five stocks, or what we call the Fab Five, get on board them early and ride them until they roll over, you can make a lot of money. But here's the catch. How many people pick up on these stocks early and how many people get out of those stocks when they come or approach a market peak? These are the kind of stocks that get clobbered when you go through a market downturn. But so far, of all the three strategies we're going to talk today, the Fab Five, Dogs of the Dow, and Dividend Aristocrats, the Fab Five is clearly the stock market leader.
You know, if we look at these returns, and typically you hear about such and such a stock is up 50%, 100%, 200%, I would assume that there's going to be some risk in there because you're going to need to know when to get out. Isn't that the real critical issue? Because a lot of people got caught in that during the various booms that we've had recently.
Well, sure. I mean, there were a lot of people that got caught up in the internet cycle between 1995 and the year 2000. I mean, everybody was going to make 15% a year. And in 1999, you had the NASDAQ up almost 70%. And then the first 3 months of 2000, the NASDAQ was up another 20% before it corrected. And by the time it got to the bottom of the cycle in the year 2002, the NASDAQ was down over 70%. The problem is when there's good news about a company, they're growing faster than the market. They seem to be the darlings of Wall Street. It reminds me of a similar period called the Nifty 50 in the early 70s, where these were the top 50 blue chip stocks from IBM to Kodak. Any stock that you could invest in, it didn't matter what you paid for the price. These were premium companies, and that's all you needed to do was hold on to them. But people never paid attention to the price. And of course, when we had the big bear market in 1974, people lost a lot of money. Likewise, when we had that bear market in 2000 and 2002, the internet and a lot of those technology stocks came crashing down, and it would be almost 13 years. Now, the NASDAQ just exceeded the 6,000 level for the first time in history. And it is one of the best performing indexes of the year. I mean, the Dow's up 6, the S&P's up 6, the NASDAQ is up double that. These were all these high-flying technology stocks reside. But the key thing, John, is if you're going to play this momentum strategy, you have to get on early and you have to be smart enough to know when these stocks are rolling over. And so people that get involved with this kind of strategy, they're going to have to use technical analysis and look at the charts. When these things are starting to roll over or momentum is starting to decline, that's usually a warning. But right now, that's where the money is going. I mean, every single day you look at the market, it's either up in a new record or it's down, as it is on this Friday with those poor GDP numbers where the economy is growing less than 1%. It's going to be interesting now to take a look at Fed funds future. Does the Fed go ahead in June or do they ignore this first quarter print? Because the second quarter GDP numbers, at least as we take a look at the LEIs, they're not that great. So typically, it's the second and third quarter when you see the best growth in the economy and consequently some of the best growth in corporate earnings. For example, you had companies like Exxon report this week. Exxon's earnings doubled, but once again, they are doubling from the absolute bottom and it hardly moved the needle on many of these stocks. But John, you're right. If you're going to employ this strategy, you better know what you're doing technically and better be sharp on the charts. Because unfortunately, what people do is they take a look at these stocks and they go, wow, this stock is up X percent this year. It's up X percent last year. I'm going to get on board. And they're not realizing, looking at the charts and following these companies from, let's say, a technical analysis point of view, so they know when to get out when these things start to roll over. They just get on board because it looks good and the stocks are going up a lot.
Let's discuss a more conservative strategy, which is called Dogs of the Dow. First of all, we need to describe that to people and then look at its track record. How well has this particular strategy done and who pursues it generally?
This strategy, there's 30 stocks in the Dow Industrials. Most of these stocks are blue chip. Most of them pay dividends. And what it is every January, you take a look at the top 10 dividend paying stocks in the Dow, and then you buy those putting equal weight, 10% in each one of these stocks, and you rotate them. For example, if you take a look at this year, we had a couple stocks fall out of the Dow, which was Procter & Gamble and Walmart. This year, there are 10 Dogs of the Dow stocks at the top of the list, and these are dividend yields going back to January 1st, because every single year you do this calculation, you buy the top 10 stocks in the Dogs of the Dow, and you hold them till December 31st, and then once again in the new year, you take the top 10. Two stocks that came out this year were Walmart and Procter & Gamble. At the top of the list, and this is going back to January 1st, was Verizon with a dividend yield of 4.3, Pfizer with a dividend of 3.9, Chevron and Boeing with a dividend yield of 3.7, Cisco, Coke, and IBM with a dividend yield of 3.4, and that, by the way, compares to the dividend yield on the Dow, which is roughly about 2.2%. Then you have Exxon and Caterpillar with a dividend yield of 3.3, and Merck finally at 3.2. Now, it's interesting. How well have the Dow stocks done this year? Verizon has actually lost close to 9%, so that drives the dividend yield. It's up close to 5. You have Pfizer. Its dividend yield has gone down just a slight bit because it's up 5% for the year, so it's keeping up close to the Dow. Chevron's dividend yield has gone to 4.1 because the stock is down about 9%. You have Boeing. That stock is up 13.6%. You've got things like Cisco that are up almost 12%. Things like Coke that are up a little over 2%. And then IBM is down a little over 3.4%. Exxon is down over 9%. Caterpillar is up almost 10.8% in Merck. So if you put an equal amount of, let's say, 10% in each one of these Dow stocks, your collective return year to date would be roughly about 2%. Versus the 6% return on the Dow. So this is a year where high-flying stocks tend to, it's more of a growth and momentum-driven market, and it's been that way since the election. So the more conservative-type approach stocks, I would say, would do well in a year where you're basically in the risk-off trade, where people will seek the safety of big blue-chip stocks and high dividend-paying stocks. So the Dogs of the Dow are underperforming, let's say, the overall Dow itself. So you're making money, but you're not making much. It's underperforming by almost 66%.
But let's assume that we're looking for some kind of a long-term strategy for investing in the market. You know, how well have the Dogs of the Dow done for, what, the last 17 years, something like that?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the Dogs of the Dow over the last 17 years, going back to the year 2000, the Dogs were up 9.4%. That compares to the Dow Industrials, which were up 6.96%, the S&P, which was up roughly 6.2%, and the Russell 3000, which was up 7%. So over a 17-year period, the Dogs of the Dow have outperformed the Dow by almost 2.5%. They've outperformed the S&P 500 by 3.25%, and they've outperformed the Russell 3000 by almost 2.4%. Now, the percentage of years that they tend to outperform the market, the Dogs tend to outperform the Dow 71% of the time, 60% of the time, outperformance of the S&P, and 60% of the time on the Russell 3000. It's actually 59-something, but I rounded it off. So if you look at this strategy over a period of time of 17 years where we experienced two bear markets, a two-year bear market from 2000 to 2002, and another two-year bear market from 2007 to 2009, over that longer stretch period of time, it has consistently beaten the average. Here's where it really becomes significant. If you take, let's say you put $10,000 in the S&P or the Dow in the year 2000, and you just let it reinvest, you basically never touched it, just allowed it to compound during good years and bad years. That $10,000, had you invested in the dogs of the Dow, would have grown to $46,000 in 17 years versus $27,600 if you invested in the S&P 500. So you can see where over a period of time, if you are outperforming an index by 2.5% to 3.25%, as it did to dogs, outperform the S&P by 3.25%, I mean, that turns out to be a significant amount of money. And that's really what you're trying to do, is if you are an investor, is you need to develop a philosophy. How do you make your investment decisions? Are you using technical analysis and you just simply follow charts? Are you a momentum investor, which we talked about? The momentum investors are the clear winners this year. The Fab Five have outperformed even the Dow and the major indexes, even outperforming the NASDAQ. So you have to decide what kind of investor. You can't be one year when jumping on board, these stocks are going up, you're a momentum investor, and then all of a sudden we get a period like 2011, 2015, where the markets went nowhere, and all of a sudden you're a conservative investor, and then somewhere in between. And especially, this becomes very important to you if you are 5 or 10 years away from retirement. What you're looking for is a consistent philosophy. And that's why we wanted to take a look at some of these different approaches, very well-known approaches on Wall Street. Fundamental analysis is what drives Wall Street. You have just a plethora of CFAs who populate the investment industry. These are people that have taken a look at and gotten a degree. It's very difficult to get to pass all three CFA exams. They operate on fundamentals. What's the economy doing? What are company earnings? And et cetera. And they base those decisions based on fundamentals. You have other investors like Warren Buffett, who basically says, you know, he looks at fundamentals, but he computes intrinsic value for a company. In other words, what is this company really worth? And if it's selling below its intrinsic value, Buffett bets the ranch. Like, for example, he took a look in November. He increased his stake in Apple, and he's already made $2 billion, one of the stellar performing stocks this year. So the important thing that we're trying to stress here is develop a philosophy. And there's plenty of them out there, but some that are time-tested and more appropriate for people that have pension plans, people that are heading into retirement, nearing retirement, or they may be currently retired.
So now we're down to the third approach, which are the dividend aristocrats. What is involved in this approach and who are they?
You know, there's two versions of this. There's something called the dividend aristocrats. These are 52 companies that have increased their dividend every single year for 25 consecutive years. And then there's another approach called dividend kings. These are companies that have increased their dividend consistently every single year for 50 years. And these are companies you would recognize, companies like Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson, 3M, companies like Lowe's. And it's amazing when you take a look at some of the dividend growth rates. Imagine if you started out your investment career, let's say, just say you're 25 years old and you don't have much money to invest, but you've got enough money to buy 10 of each one of the dogs of the Dow. These are companies that have increased their dividends. You buy the ones that have increased their dividend every single year. Imagine holding these companies for a 50-year period during your working career, and every single year you get a pay increase. And these pay increases could be as little as 9% for a company like Coke, 9% for Procter & Gamble, or Clorox, 10%. I mean, it's amazing, but every single year you get a pay increase. And even during good years and bad years, these companies have done very well. For example, there was a study done on dividend aristocrats, and it was done from 1991 to 2015. And by the way, there are a couple of ETFs right now that are out there that duplicate these dividend aristocrats. I think the oldest one came into an existence in the year 2013. But there was a study done on dividend aristocrats between 1991 and 2015. Now, during that period of time, the S&P went up 9.8% a year. So had you invested a dollar in the S&P in 1991, it was worth $11.44 at the end of 2015. The dividend aristocrats, however, went up 14.1% a year. In other words, they outperformed the S&P by 4.3 percentage points a year. And here's the difference. Your $1 in 1991 would have grown to $31.02 by the end of 2015 versus the S&P 500, 11.44.
Well, you must admit, Jim, the last, 17 years have been sort of nutty. I mean, we had the tech bubble in the 1990s, and that, of course, popped. There was the great financial crisis after the bubble, largely in housing and credit, burst between 2007-2009. How well did these companies do during market downturns? And then how do they do when the stock market's going back up?
You know, they outperformed the majority of the time on years the market's going up, and they outperformed on the downside. And this is very important, as last week we covered, you know, when things get crazy, don't get lazy and focus on risk. So if you look at 2016, the Dividend Aristocrats produced 19% returns versus the S&P 10%. In the year 2015, a year the market went nowhere, the Aristocrats produced a 2% return versus 1% for the S&P. Now let's take a look at some crazy years. 2014, the Aristocrats did a 14% return equal to the S&P, so they kept pace. 2013, the Aristocrats did 31% versus the S&P 500, 32%. So they underperformed by 1%, so you could say pretty much kept even. In 2012, Aristocrats were up 17% versus 16% for the Dow. In 2011, everybody remembers 2011, Fukushima, the Arab Spring, the debt ceiling debate, the pig crisis, all of that stuff was happening. The Aristocrats did 6% versus 2% for the S&P. In 2010, they did 20% versus 15% for the S&P. 2009, when the bull market took off, when the Fed started QE1, they underperformed the S&P. The Aristocrats did 19%. The S&P did 27%. But here's where it gets important. In 2008, the Aristocrats lost 15% versus 37% for the S&P. In 2007, the Aristocrats did 9% versus 6%. And this is what you have to keep in mind. When it gets crazy, like it did in 1999, the Aristocrats only did 11% when the S&P did 21%. But in the year 2000, when the bubble burst, Aristocrats were up 7%. The S&P was down 9%. 2001, Aristocrats were up 11%. The S&P was down 12%. And the worst year, in 2002, the Aristocrats were only down 3% versus the loss of 22%. For the S&P 500. So there's one thing that's perfectly clear here. In most of the years of a bull market, the Aristocrats either outperform or at least equal the return of the S&P. So that stands out. So you're not foregoing superior returns by investing in the more conservative Aristocrats. Number two, and I think this is more important, in a market downturn like we had in 2008, you lost 15% in the Aristocrats versus 37% in the S&P 500. And also, likewise, in the downturn between 2000 and 2002, there was only one year during that three-year downturn where you lost money, and it was only 3% in the year 2002 when the S&P lost 22%. So you outperformed the market, and you had positive returns in the year 2000, positive returns, almost double the returns of the S&P, 11% in 2001 versus a 12% loss in the S&P 500. It's amazing, John, as simple as this strategy is, how little it's employed by investors or on Wall Street. So basically what you're doing is you're buying blue chip companies. And by blue chip, that means they have a strong balance sheet. They have a strong franchise. They have a history. I mean, you're going to be, there is no guarantees when you go into the market. Just because a company has raised their dividend every single year for 25 years with Aristocrats or with Aristocrat Kings 50 years, that doesn't mean that they may get into trouble one year and they don't raise them. But it gives you a good degree of confidence that if you invest in these type of companies or you invest in ETF, that your returns are likely to be more consistent. Number two, less volatile. Three, protect you more in a downturn, and four, superior long-term performance over a number of years. And that's one reason why we like dividends. Of course, if you've been listening to this show, You know that since going back to 2012, we've been telling you about dividend stocks. We still like them today, just like we did in 2012, and for these good reasons.
So if we pull all of this together, there are three different ways of making money in the market, at least three different strategies. Number one, the Fab Five. And again, that means buy the biggest momentum stocks in the market. If we did that this year, 2017, clearly the outperformers in all three. But remember, you get in trouble if your timing is off because you need to know when to get out. These are high price stocks and you can get really badly hurt if you don't get out at the right point. Number two, dogs of the Dow. You pick the 10 highest dividend paying stocks. And of course, you rebalance that each year. For the last 17 years, the dogs of the Dow have outperformed the Dow, the S&P 500 and the Russell 3000. So there you go. And finally, dividend aristocrats, best returns in good markets and bad markets. They have a long history, over 25 to 50 years of these solid companies increasing their dividends every single year. How many of you, say, for example, could get a pay raise each year that goes from 5 to 15%? So I have one question listening to all these three as we were talking about it, Jim. How about a mix strategy? Like you apportion one part of a portfolio to follow one strategy and another to follow another strategy, etc. Is that workable?
I suspect that, you know, you could probably do a mixture between the dividend aristocrats and the dogs of the Dow. But I think if you try to do that with a mixture of the Fab Five, it's almost, John, like two different philosophies. It would be like, you know, you're a Christian and also a Buddhist. I mean, it's very hard for people to be adept at both kind of strategies. Momentum investing requires a totally different skill set. You have to be really adept at reading charts. You have to have a very sophisticated software where you pick up on the momentum stocks that are breaking out, that are moving the markets, and then you have to get on board and you have to know when to get off. I mean, that's a big, big load to carry as an investor. And it's almost like two opposing viewpoints. One is philosophical, it's sound. The other one is just like, hey, we're going to chase stuff and we're going to chase the stuff that's moving, and I'm going to be smart enough to get off when they peak. I haven't met anybody that's been that smart.
Okay. Just wanted to ask because I'm sure that's going on in the minds of some people. So those are your three strategies, and you know, pick which one you think will work for you and then follow it.
Yeah. And there's also the nice thing about ETFs. There's ETFs for everything. There's dividend aristocrat ETFs. Every fund company has a different version of it. You'll have to take a look at what it consists of. And there's also an ETF with the dogs of the Dow. So if you don't want to buy them individually, maybe you don't have the money, you can go and employ this strategy through ETFs. The momentum stocks, well, you're going to have to buy them individually, and you're going to have to be smart enough to know when to pick them and when to dump them.
Coming up next on The Big Picture, an extensive interview with Louis Gav from GavCal Research as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Well, I like to look at certain metrics and certain patterns of past cycles, Chris. The broad look at the simple Purchasing Managers Index, the PMI, the J.P. Morgan Global Manufacturing PMI numbers are around 53.8 now. Inspection territory and increasing at a faster rate. But looking at the various country sectors, their manufacturing bases, the new order flows, employment trends, those type of things in the various marketplaces are all showed a new phase last year turning up and sort of kicked in really more in a more concerted fashion in the third quarter of last year.
Well, despite the growing geopolitical tensions, whether you're looking at North Korea, Syria, Afghanistan, or other places in the world, including Venezuela, the markets seem to be pretty sanguine. Even though there's a military buildup going on in Asia, stock markets are at record levels, with the Nasdaq crossing over 6,000. As the markets become complacent, or serious issues at stake? Joining me on the program from GavCal Research is Louis Gav. Louis, let's talk about this morning's Wall Street Journal talks about China launching and building its second aircraft carrier, building naval bases in the area. The U.S. has an armada moving into the area, including a missile-striking submarine. So what's your take on all this? Is this just a show of force in order to get to negotiations, or is something more serious happening here?
I think it's both, to hedge my bets. On the one hand, structurally, China is going to continue building a navy. And China is going to continue to want to show force on the naval front for the very simple reason that if you look at a map of China, historically, China was built along its rivers, right? And so economic centers were really spread out across the country, mostly along the Yellow River and Yangtze River. The big change of the past 20 years is all economic activity has basically shifted from being scattered around China to being all along the coast. So if you're a Chinese leader and you look at this and you say, okay, all my economic centers and centers of production are now along the coast and I need to defend those, the only way I can do so really is by having a world-class navy. So China really has no choice but to continue investing in a navy and in an air force. So I think we will continue to see announcements like launches of aircraft carriers. And, you know, this aircraft carriers was obviously planned years ago. The fact that it's being launched now, you could say, well, it's either China wanting to show a show of strength vis-a-vis the North Korea situation, or it just happens to be this way. Now, when it comes to North Korea, I think, and to your point of the markets brushing it off, I think the markets have been used for the past, really, decades of North Korea being run by nut jobs. And I think that's why it's being brushed off, just like all the trouble in the Middle East is being brushed off. You know, for the past 10 years, you've had a growing civil war in the Middle East between the Sunnis and the Shiites. And so the markets have just learned to kind of brush this off and say, okay, well, this doesn't matter. And it's just more of the same. And perhaps it is, perhaps it isn't. I think the saving grace on North Korea, the impression that everybody has, that at the end of the day, China still controls a lot of the situation there. And that if the situation ever gets really bad, Kim Jong-un will be replaced by some other general or something, and there'll be a coup, and we'll have an outcome that ends up being friendlier. Whether that corresponds to reality or not, or whether North Korea is more of a loose cannon, for me, is a big uncertainty. There's no doubt. And, yeah, I think that's a Damocles sword at this point, hanging above a lot of markets, above the Chinese market, above the Korean market, above the Japanese market. These are real sources of concern, no doubt.
Yeah, because there seems to be a regime change in Washington. We had the Syrian strikes, the dropping of Moab in Afghanistan, and for the first time, we are showing incredible force moving into the area. Now, maybe this is just done to let the North Korean leader say, hey, we're serious, don't think of doing this kind of thing, and get it down to negotiations. But the other problem that you always have, Louis, is when you have these things happen and you move forces into the area, there's always the possibility for conflict. I mean, that's exactly what happened in World War One. When you have an arms race and you pit two opposing sides across from each other, sometimes accidents happen and conflicts are ignited.
Potentially. I think one of the reasons for this big arms race, as you put it, is that I think Donald Trump is falling back on what U.S. presidents find easiest, which is basically foreign policies and show of strength militarily. I think in his first 100 days, he's had a bunch of stumbles domestically. Obviously, the Obamacare reform, the challenge in getting a tax plan through, although, you know, he's just proposed something. We'll have to see whether that goes through Congress or not. It looks unlikely that it will. So domestically, he hasn't had a lot of wins. And obviously, Donald Trump likes being a winner. So you look for wins elsewhere. And the easy wins are dropping huge bombs on Afghanistan and deploying big armadas to Asia. Whether that ends up leading to something worse. Hopefully cooler heads prevail. And I mean, the big flashpoint is North Korea, because they are such an unpredictable nature that if they start to try to want to test nuclear bombs or whatever else, it could start getting ugly. So yeah, no, I agree with you. It's a Damocles sword over markets today.
Well, and speaking of markets, let's talk about that. What surprised everybody after the election, the stock market, instead of going down, went up. We now have the second most expensive stock market in history. And Lori, a lot of that was based on the assumptions that three things would get done. Here we are. We've already surpassed 100 days. One would be tax cuts. Second would be infrastructure spending. Three would be deregulation. Now, we've had some deregulation with executive orders, but we couldn't get health care passed. They're talking about tax cuts. It remains to be seen if that's will be done. At the same time, you have a Fed rate raising cycle that's occurring in an economy that really isn't that robust. We're barely growing at 2%. So is there a possibility that at some point the stock market wakes up and says, wait a minute, all these things that we've been anticipating may take longer to happen if they happen at all?
Absolutely. And though I think at the same time, you've had one very important change that perhaps people in the U.S. haven't perceived as strongly, and that's the fact that growth, you know, for years, the U.S. was the only growth story in town, right? And if you wanted growth, you had to come in the U.S. And the story back then was, the U.S. is the best-looking house in an ugly street kind of thing. And that's no longer really true. If you look at the past 12 months, Europe has actually grown faster than the U.S. You're getting growth in Japan. And, of course, the really big surprise of the past 12 months has been that China, instead of slowing down, has reaccelerated. And this has obviously pulled growth higher because China is such a pulling force for all of Asia and, in fact, all of emerging markets, that the rebound in Chinese growth has pulled growth in emerging markets higher. And so what you're finding now since the beginning of the year is that the U.S. dollar is no longer that strong, and a lot of emerging markets and other currencies are now going up against the U.S. dollar, whether you look at sterling, whether you look at the yen, whether you look at the Korean won or even the euro now. So that's one thing. And the other thing, markets outside of the U.S. are starting to outperform. And this makes perfect sense to me because over the past 5 years, as you point out, U.S. equity markets got really, really expensive. They got really expensive, again, because the U.S. was the best-looking house in an ugly street. And global capital, not just U.S. money, but global money, kept flowing into U.S. equities. Well, now all of a sudden, you have opportunities in Asia, you have opportunities in Japan, you have opportunities in Europe, and these markets are starting to outperform, and they're starting from a much, much cheaper base than U.S. markets. So perhaps the story of the next few years will be the U.S. kind of consolidating and digesting its current overvaluation while other markets catch up. That would be the bullish scenario. The bearish scenario is one where we have a shock to the system, and a shock to the system which could either come from what we mentioned, something geopolitical, something coming out of left field, or as the Fed continues its tightening cycle, some over-levered player goes bust, which frequently happens when the Fed tightens. And there is a lot of debt in the system. And the reality is, of course, you'd never know who's going to go bust until it happens. So you get your Fed tightening cycle, and this triggers a financial accident, most likely in the U.S., because that's where most of the leverage is. And then the U.S. goes down hard, and everybody goes down hard with it. So for me, the way I look at it today is your relative value is undeniably in equities outside of the U.S. And now that they're starting to outperform, now that the momentum is behind them, there's really no reason to be underweight global equities. You want to be overweight global equities, underweight the U.S.
And so how does one hedge in a market like this? Because, you know, if you take a look at the capital market line, which starts with T-bills going all the way to junk bonds and high-risk commodities, we're starting, Louis, at a much lower level. I mean, it's hard to believe around this time last year, we were heading down to 1.3%, almost a third of all sovereign debt was yielding negative interest rates. I mean, Switzerland could have borrowed for 20, 30 years, and you would have had to pay the Swiss government. What is the risk here?
To be honest, if you think of a bad accident happening, whether it's North Korea, whether it's somebody going bust, the most likely response of the Fed will be to come out and say, oh, we're on hold now, we're not going to do anything, or perhaps even cut, you know. But if you get a war against North Korea, I don't see how the Fed can potentially raise interest rates. And I think this is why, if you look at really the past 12 months, you've had an uncanny and frankly unusual correlation between gold, gold miners, and U.S. Treasuries, where they're all now reacting basically to perceived tightening bias from the Fed. So when the Fed is perceived to be tightening, both bonds and gold goes down, like has happened in the past few days with the perception that, okay, the risk in Europe is off given the French election, etc. Or when the risk is on, then all of a sudden U.S. Treasuries catch a bid, and so do gold and gold miners. So you know, in a sense, gold miners have become a sort of high beta play on the Fed easing. So for me, one potential hedge in portfolios is to own gold miners. And you don't need to own a lot because they're so high beta compared to, say, U.S. Treasuries, that if you own a few gold miners, yes, if everything goes well in the world, your gold miners will do nothing. But if everything goes badly, your gold miners will probably be rallying pretty hard.
So given where we are right now, and we've seen the dollar come down, let's talk a bit about, for the last 4 or 5 years, as we've been speaking, the U.S. has been the best game in town. We've had a better economy. Our markets were performing better. And of course, we started from a lower base right after the financial crisis. One of the things I think surprises people, another factor moving the dollar lower, is when economic growth picks up overseas. I wonder if we could spend a few moments and discuss the implications for that and what that might mean for, let's say, other asset classes.
Absolutely. When you think of where the pent-up demand is in the world, you know, where the balance sheets of individuals are unlevered, the balance sheets of corporations are unlevered, where potentially, you know, you can get many years of ramping up of capital spending and consumption, etc. To me, the U.S. definitely doesn't come out on top. Leverage in the U.S. is very high. It's almost back to record highs. And, you know, it's not as if the U.S. is a coiled spring ready to bounce thanks to either tax cuts or thanks to deregulation or whatever else. Not that tax cuts and deregulation don't help. They're great. But the U.S. is not a coiled spring economy. If you're looking for coiled spring economies today, where really you've had very little capital spending, very little increase in consumer leverage, you can find that in Japan for sure. You can find that in India, and you can find that in large parts of Europe. You know, Europe, for the past 10 years, all you've had is deleveraging, consolidations of balance sheets. And this seems to now be turning a corner. You know, last year was the first year in eons where European growth was higher than U.S. growth. And still, monetary policy remains very easy in Europe. And political risk, well, we'll know more in 10 days' time, but there's a good chance that political risk is abating. And so you put all this together, and so to me, the growth potential at this stage is much more, indeed, outside of the U.S. than inside the U.S., which is, you know, a good thing. You know, it's not feasible that the U.S. carries the can for decade after decade after decade.
You're a Frenchman. What's your take on the French elections and the likely outcome and what it might mean for Europe and also the markets there?
To be honest, I think it's going to be tighter than the market expects. So, you know, where we got a second round between Marine Le Pen, who's very much the anti-EU, anti-globalization, protectionist candidate, and Emmanuel Macron, who's a man who really comes out of nowhere, 38 years old. Nobody had heard of him 2 years ago, never been elected to public office. He was Minister of Finance for 9 months. And what's happened in France, obviously, is we've chosen two candidates to go into the final round that basically represent nothing of the old political consensus. In the old days, everything was always split between the Socialist Party and the center-right party, and they've both imploded in this election. So the first thing is, obviously, voters, they voted for change. We just don't know what kind of change they voted for. Now, all the opinion polls tell you Macron's going to win by two-thirds in the second round. I think it's going to be much tighter for a number of reasons, including, most likely, a fairly low turnout. And while Le Pen's voters are very motivated, Macron's voters are less motivated. So I personally would wait until after the election to put on risk massively. You know, the election is coming out in 10 days' time. To me, there's still the odds, even if the odds are low, the possibility of an upset and a Le Pen win is still there. The markets are basically pricing in this as zero probability. I still think there's a chance it could happen. So I'd be more inclined to pile risk on in Europe after that election, because let's make no mistake about it. If Le Pen wins, it's a massive political crisis in Europe and upheaval, and you probably don't want to have any capital in Europe for quite a while. After that, you know, there's the French parliamentary elections, and these will show whether Macron can follow a real program of reform or not. And there's the chance that France ends up with political paralysis following the legislative election. Now, that's not too much of a risk for markets. Markets are happy if you get a sort of soft consensus out of France. If you get positive reform, though, then I think you have to be very, very bullish France, depending on what comes out of the legislative elections. But, you know, if the parliamentary elections turn out to be a bit of a dud, then you won't have a crisis in Europe, you won't have a crisis in markets, but France just won't be as exciting as it could have been.
So as you view these markets, we've had U.S. stocks now in their eighth year of basically rising to record levels. You've had depressed prices in Japan for as long as I can remember. Same thing in Europe. Well, let's talk about the opportunities there, because it seems like if you're looking to sort of de-risk a portfolio, that would be the place to be. The other advantage, Louis, is some of the dividend yields, for example, on European stocks have always been much higher in comparison to U.S. markets, and likewise with some of these Japanese stocks now.
The yields in Japan aren't that great. They're okay, but they're not that great. You get just as good a yield in the U.S., if not better. But you're absolutely right that in Europe, dividend yields can be a good bit higher than those of the U.S. And so, you know, for income-oriented investors, there's definitely opportunities. Not only that, but look, the best thing you can do is buy undervalued stocks in undervalued currencies, because you get a potential double kicker in terms of returns. And today, I think you are seeing that, where you are seeing undervalued equities outside of the U.S. in undervalued currencies. And the momentum has now moved your way, because these stocks are now starting to outperform and the currencies are starting to outperform. So, you know, I tend to believe there's three ways to make money in the market. You look for return to the mean trades, you look for momentum trades, you look for carry trades, to your point on yield. And today, you know, in places like Europe, places like emerging markets, even in Japan, you can find all three. You can find some carry with high dividend yield. You find positive momentum, both in absolute and relative terms. And you find very good return to the mean opportunities, at least relative to those in the U.S., with the stocks that are not overly valued. So, no, I think the trend of U.S. underperformance, which seems to have just started, is one that will continue for the next few years. That doesn't mean the U.S. crashes and that you have to go out and sell all your U.S. equities. It's just that the opportunity set abroad is a lot more compelling.
And of course, you can de-risk too. If you're getting, let's say, a higher dividend yield, that reduces some of the risk while you're waiting for stocks to gain or the currencies to move. Do you see the dollar, as growth picks up in Europe and as it picks up, let's say, in Asia right now with China and Japan, that the dollar could head much lower? Because a lot of the thinking, Louis, was with the interest rate spreads between the U.S. and what you see overseas in Japan and Europe, that that would rally the dollar. But as we saw after the last rate hike coming in March, right after December, the dollar went down.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, let me put it to you this way. If growth is confirmed in Europe and inflation continues to pick up, the ECB will have to somewhat stop its massive record of easing monetary policy. And if it stops expanding its balance sheet or, God forbid, even raise interest rates, then for me, there's no doubt in my mind that the euro will shoot up, because Europe has a very large current account surplus now. And really, the only reason the euro is weak is the extremely easy European monetary policy that kind of forces any yield-seeking investors into U.S. treasuries against European bonds. Take that away and put interest rates a little bit higher in Europe, and all of a sudden, capital comes flowing back. So, no, I think the risk is very much on the downside in the U.S. dollar against pretty much any currency you care to think of, unless you think that the Fed is going to be much more aggressive, much more quickly, and for much longer than the market currently expects. Now, I tend to believe that when the Fed tells us there's two more rate hikes this year, and that's pretty much what the market is pricing in, I tend to think that's more or less what we'll get. I'd be very surprised if we get more out of the U.S. And if there's any bad news that comes out, whether geopolitically or a financial accident or anything else, the risk is on the downside of that vision, that you don't get two rate hikes and you just get one or even zero. And if that happens, of course, the dollar goes down, because right now the market is pricing in those two rate hikes, and it's pricing in absolutely nothing from the ECB or the BOJ. So, no, unless you want to believe that the Fed is going to be much more aggressive going forward, which I'm not, then there's no real reason to be massively bullish the dollar.
Well, let's talk about another market. And as you mentioned, one way to hedge uncertainty would be, let's say, gold stocks, because they're high beta. You wouldn't have to put much in the sector. What about commodities? Let's talk about oil and gold. What's your take there?
On oil, I think, you know, we've had the bursting of a massive bubble. Whenever you've had a bubble, bubbles always are built around an erroneous belief. And the erroneous belief around the bubble in oil that we had when oil was between $100 and $150 a barrel was the belief in peak oil. Turns out that, as in every other previous cycles, the cure to high oil price is a high oil price. with the high oil price, you get a bunch of supply coming on. And now we know that there's tons and tons of supply everywhere. Not only that, but producers are getting ever more productive in getting that supply out of the ground. You know, if you look at the U.S. today, the U.S. oil production is basically at record highs, and the oil rig count is half of what it was 10 years ago. So per rigs, you guys are getting so much more oil out of the ground. And whenever the oil price moves above 50, the supply comes out of the woodwork. It comes out of the woodwork in the U.S. It comes out of the woodwork in Brazil. It comes out of the woodwork in Russia. Now, we're entering into the summer period when Russian oil production always goes up because, you know, getting oil out of Siberia in the winter is hard work. Getting it out of the summer is much easier. We're coming into a period where Saudi Arabia has done its very best to keep the oil price around $50 because Saudi needs the oil price at 50 bucks to get the Saudi Aramco IPO out of the door. If the oil price collapses, the attractiveness of doing the IPO for Saudi collapses. Now, at the same time, we know there's an underlying war in the Middle East between Saudi on the one hand and Iran and Russia on the other. And the last thing Iran and Russia will want is for the Saudi Aramco IPO to go up smoothly. So I think Russia is going to be cranking up production like crazy this summer in a bid to screw Saudi Arabia, excuse my French. And so I find it very hard to be bullish oil. I don't see how it stays above $50. Whenever it goes to close to 50, there's supply coming on. And I think right now, for geopolitical reason, there's real risk on the downside.
As we conclude here, Louis, given the fact that U.S. markets are extremely elevated at this point, especially in comparison to other markets, things you might consider if you were investing would be in areas such as Europe, which is growing much faster now. Stocks are cheaper. You got higher dividend yields. Likewise, in some of these Asian markets or maybe India.
Yeah, we've been huge fans of India for the past few years. It's our biggest overweight in our Asian fund. You know, what's happening in India is simply remarkable under the leadership of Modi. Let me ask you a question. Do you know how many bank accounts were opened in India in the past couple of years?
Several million.
200 million individuals opening bank accounts in India in the past 2 years. That's a game changer because what you're seeing in India is all the savings that used to be basically kept under the mattress or just kept in gold and jewelry are now being deposited at the bank and thus reintermediated, which provides capital for investments, capital for infrastructure spending, and so on. This is exactly what we saw in China about 20 years ago. So the changes that are happening in India are, to me, remarkable on a lot of fronts, partly because we've seen this movie before and we saw it with China. Now, of course, India isn't going to go at the same pace as China did, but it's nonetheless a very, very exciting story. And there's great ways to play it. I'll give you just a couple examples. The biggest online travel agency in India is a company called Make My Trip. It's actually listed in the U.S., MMYT. If I'm not mistaken, I think the market cap is $7 or $8 billion. You compare that to Ctrip in China, which is basically the same thing. Ctrip is a Chinese Expedia or Travelocity. I think Ctrip's a market cap of about $25 billion or $28 billion. And then if you look at compared market cap to Expedia, I think Expedia is at like $75 billion. Just to give you the range of ideas. Now, the growth of Make My Trip in India, of MMYT, is going to be phenomenal for the 10 years to come. And it's trading at a tenth of Expedia. So there's still some terrific opportunities in India.
Well, listen, Louis, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do at GavCal Research, tell them how they could do so.
But the easiest way is to go to our website, which is gavcal.com, G-A-V-E-K-A-L, and they can find out all the information they need there. That's probably the easiest way.
Okay, so we have three strategies for investing, and what kind of strategies for looking for the week ahead or weeks ahead?
Well, in the weeks ahead, we're still looking at earnings season. It's going to be interesting, John, with that low GDP print. Even though the LAIs are still in positive territory, they're not really booming. So second quarter could be probably a little better than first quarter, but not a very strong quarter as it has been. So maybe this is going to give the president more ammunition for stimulus, whether it's tax cuts or fiscal spending. But it's interesting, given on this Friday with this low GDP print, the futures market is still betting a 63% chance the Fed will raise interest rates when it comes to June by a quarter of a point. So it looks like, at least right now, the futures market is actually, that percentage has increased. It was up 40-something percent, then 50%. It's now at 63%. on this Friday. So futures are still expecting another Fed rate hike coming as soon as June. So we're going to want to watch the economic data, because remember, whatever the Fed says one day, they can also change on another day. So we're going to watch the economic numbers to see if this weak trend in economic growth is being carried over into the second quarter of the year. So those are the things we're going to be looking at, the economy and earnings. And next week, we're going to do a special program on the age of volatility, how the oil markets have shifted and actually gone back to a period similar to the beginning of the 19th century when oil was discovered before Standard Oil consolidated the industry. That'll be coming up next week. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.